It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. I escaped the snow in Chicago just in time to come to the low country of South Carolina to work on some projects that hopefully will help make our world a better place when it comes to conservation. So I'm actually not in the studio this morning, but I'm in the pine woods of the low country, southwest of Charleston. You go southeast of Charleston, of course, in the Atlantic. So I'm going to start off the show with talking about what is affectionately and commonly known as the low country. And it's exactly what it means, low. Some of the lowest laying lands on the eastern seaboard are on the coast of South Carolina, just north of Charleston, on down through Savannah. Charleston, as some of you may have read or know, is actually the lowest lying city on the eastern seaboard. And while we hear about Charleston for its great revival, and of course it's many, many hundred year old plus houses that have been restored over time and very vibrant. And I must say, when I think of Charleston and I walk around Charleston, I think of what New Orleans, frankly, used to be. And it's incredibly clean. No, I'm not going to talk about urban cities here on the Great Outdoors Show, but I can tell you Charleston's a fabulous city to visit. But I'm not sure how great it is when it comes to the flooding that's taking place. And I had watched this firsthand the other day, a little bit of rain, a little bit of wind, a rising tide, and areas that were dry the day before have a couple inches of water on the streets and has nowhere to go. Charleston is, in fact, if you look at what NOAA says and others have to say about geographic locations that are going to be some of the toughest areas to navigate when it comes to the future, provided sea level rise keeps occurring, Charleston's number one. I think New Orleans very close behind it. So here are two areas of the world that I spend a lot of time in and a lot of people from Chicago spend time in, and both of them are going to be seriously challenged. So the low country of South Carolina, though, is some of the most important wintering waterfowl country on the continent. Many birds come across from the prairies. Believe it or not, the pintail in South Carolina and Georgia and North Carolina don't come down the Atlantic Flyway. They don't come out of New Brunswick or Nova Scotia or Labrador or Quebec. No, no. They come from Saskatchewan and Manitoba and the Dakotas, and they go southeast across the continent. A lot of them cut across Long Point on Lake Erie, and then they keep coming on down, they fly crosswise across the country. This is true of a lot of songbirds in South Carolina. Shorebirds as well. We think of ducks and geese and cranes and swans because we're in the Mississippi Flyway, pretty much being linear north and south. That's true for us. But for the Atlantic Flyway, the southern part of the Atlantic Flyway, that's not true at all. These birds that I've seen over the past couple of days as I've toured the marsh country, they're coming from, and they're flying over us in Chicago. They're coming from the northwest, Manitoba, Saskatchewan. They're not really coming from Alberta. That's too far, except for some pintail. But the low country is much like the coast of marshes of Louisiana, which I've talked about a lot and certainly will a lot more because that's so directly relevant to us in Chicago and transportation and wildlife. The low country is really the pulse of the southern end of the Atlantic Flyway. It's also incredibly important estuary country for shrimp and crabs and redfish. And it's a culture all to its own, much like the Cajun culture of South Louisiana. The culture in the low country is also different, historic, and Charleston, from Charleston to Savannah, is really the hub of that. And so it's a great place to visit, particularly in February when Chicago's experiencing a little more winter. And while we've had some cold, we certainly haven't had much snow, so we got a little bit this week. But you'll hear more about the low country, I think, in the coming years, because it is in the corner. It's absolutely in the crosshairs of how are we going to navigate rising sea levels, and they are rising. How are we going to navigate rising sea levels at the same time that we're going to protect all kinds of migratory bird corridors and also freshwater estuaries. And one of the great problems with rising sea levels, whether it be in Louisiana or in the low country of South Carolina and Georgia, it actually goes all the way to Jacksonville, Florida, is saltwater intrusion and how freshwater areas become increasingly saline and ultimately salty, and that changes the entire marsh. So moving from the low country, where, by the way, I also should say, this is an incredible birder's paradise. Spending a couple days on boats out in the marsh, looking at wetland restoration projects and seeing what's happened in the Ace Basin and other areas, it's an avian. If you're a bird watcher, you should put the low country on your radar screen. The number of birds, wetland-dependent birds, shorebirds, songbirds, the beaches, the barrier islands, it is an extraordinary place to watch birds. So we have a new director, or we're going to have a new director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Absolutely fantastic. Truly fantastic. And that director's name is Brian Nesvik, who is from Wyoming. And why do I say this is fantastic? I don't personally know Brian Nesvik, but his background is one that exemplifies what I've been talking about now for months, the sea change, and it's not political. And I want to underscore that. Last week I talked about civility and the need for us really in the conservation world and elsewhere, but particularly the conservation world, to be able to have conversations even if we disagree. His background is in the bullseye of what we want to have running the Fish and Wildlife Service. He's a retired game warden. Guys like Lloyd Jones and John Cooper are probably absolutely applauding, both individuals you've heard many times on the Great Outdoors Show. He is the former head of the Game and Fish Commission in the state of Wyoming. He has made it his mission to bring kids into the outdoors. And time again, looking at his background, reading some of his speeches, you get directly the impression this is real. This is sincere. And in his retirement speech a little over a year ago, when he retired from head of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, he said, "My objective is getting kids and families into the outdoors." And he talked about how he came up with that background and how he spent so much of his life trying to get kids and families into the outdoors to hunt and fish and enjoy the outdoors. And that is how we're going to win this. We are not going to win it if those of you listening to this radio or podcast don't get the next generation and the generation below that, depending on your age, involved in the outdoors. And it's been my mantra for years. You've heard me talk about it, and you've heard me talk about my frustrations about how we move away from that and when the impediments we create to taking kids hunting and taking kids fishing and particularly hunting and all the hurdles we have now. And the statistics don't lie. In this case, the statistics are absolutely accurate. We are hemorrhaging young individuals in the culture of hunting. And we're hemorrhaging them, as you've heard me say so many times, because we make it so hard to be able to go hunting. So the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service can have an outsized role in the policies of the Fish and Wildlife Service. I certainly look forward to meeting him and to having him on the Great Outdoors Show and talking about what some of his interests are. And hopefully we can do that in the near future. It likely won't happen until after he's confirmed. But assuming he's confirmed, I think we have an individual who is steeped in the heritage of hunting and fishing and families in the outdoors. He comes from a background of wildlife management, so that's a real plus. And I hope that he can be the kind of successful director that all of us can support with our intentions of growing our tent of people who want to hunt and fish and not increasingly adding impediments. I'll be back in just a moment. More on the Great Outdoors. And when I do, I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened with the California fires and pollution. And then I'm going to talk about something that's brewing in our oceans and maybe some more if I have time on the Great Outdoors. Thank you so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, but Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And moving on from what I think is really the very encouraging news of the nominated now, Brian Nesvick, to be director of the Fish and Wildlife Service news, to a story that has broken recently, which talks about forests. And you know, I spend a fair amount of time talking about forests because I think they so impact our lives. And the long-term, unfortunately, mismanagement of our forests really has an impact. California fires, not the fires we just experienced tragically in recent months, but the fires of 3 years ago. They have come out with some statistics on the amount of pollution and carbon and global warming, if you will, energy that the fires in California 3 years produced. Are you ready for this number? I couldn't believe it, but it's now been verified in several places. The fires of California 3 years ago produced more emissions than all of the emissions saved in California through their pollution control policies over the last 50 years. And this is not something I could make up. They've analyzed it and they've determined that the impacts of those fires basically wiped out 50 years of gains of California reducing its emissions. Just those fires. And we haven't gotten the data, and it'll be quite a while before we get the data on the emissions produced from the fires that, of course, incinerated Pacific Palisades, Pasadena, and other areas. And those fires are different because those emissions were filled with incredibly toxic chemicals from all the melting of plastics and all the household appliances and everything that burned. The toxicity of those fires has made the air quality to the east, Palm Desert, Palm Springs, has been absolutely horrible for most of the winter. And individuals there are breathing some of the dirtiest air on earth, and yet California has some of the most stringent pollution control practices, probably singularly the most stringent pollution controls in the world. And yet the air is completely unsuited to breathe as a result of these fires in many areas. So managing our forests is readily apparent when you look at the pollution caused by these fires. But think about that. Half a century of efforts to reduce the carbon emissions from California. If you total up that entire savings over 50 years, was wiped out by the events of the fires in California 3 years ago. And two summers ago, who can forget the forest fires that were in Canada and it caused basically redouts in the sky in Washington, as far south as Washington, D.C., and New York was covered with, their cars were covered with soot from fires, and the politicians in D.C. woke up to what is happening, what caused this. The data's in on those fires as well. The fires from Canada of two summers ago made Canada the fifth largest pollution emitter in the world. Canada only has 40 million people, has fewer people in the state of California. The impact from those fires made it the fifth largest pollution emitter in the world for that period of time. Managing our forests is not only central to the health of our forests and the wildlife and our water quality and what depends on the forest directly, it's incredibly important to us. And we cannot make significant gains in air quality and reduce carbon emissions if we are going to have these apocalyptic fires that are occurring. And they're going to occur more and more frequently as there's more and more dead timber from more and more years of mismanagement. It's my fervent hope when I talk to you this morning that the U.S. Forest Service, which I think is going to get a complete remake in the coming months, begins to address the quality of human life and the impacts that human life has on all of us from forest fires. So we are really in a period here where we're beginning to get the data on just how impactful forest fires are and how detrimental they are, not only to the environment, but how detrimental they are to human health. And I think the Forest Service is going to, for the first time, and it's coming, I believe, for the first time, take human health considerations into account when it starts evaluating whether or not to put out fires. More importantly than that is figuring out how we stop these fires from beginning with by managing our forests. I got time for one more subject before we have to go on this Sunday morning in February. That is oceans and the pollution that's coming in our oceans. I'm going to talk more about this next week, but there are areas of the world now where the shorelines, and Belize is among them, and Belize has some of the toughest pollution standards of any country in Central America, where unfortunately their shorelines are now covered with litter. And this is litter from our oceans. This is litter deposited by the mega cruise ships that once they get out in international waters and a certain distance offshore can empty all their garbage into the oceans. And some of you may say it's not possible. I'm going to have a lot more for you. This is a coming crisis in many ways, but it's also a coming cause. How are we going to make cruise ships environmentally responsible? They have suddenly become maybe the ocean's largest polluters. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great week in the great outdoors. I'll be back next Sunday morning. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.